Good morning. Let's get started. I just want to put the projector up here for a moment. Let me turn off the light in the front just so you can see it, but that was not. There we go. Okay, so this is the results from your assignment. What I did was I took all the responses. I did the sort unique. I also tried getting rid of carriage returns, and I did try turning everything into lowercase. That didn't seem to make much of a difference in what I got out. So I just listed the ones that occurred at least twice. So I got rid of all the singletons. So that naturally gets rid of all of your names and anything else. So if any names appear twice, then I'll be like, that's a little funny. So I thought it was interesting just kind of listing the things that got listed. So y'all use... Well, let's make it a little bigger so you can... So you all use firewalls, okay. The Windows Firewall, Windows Defender, HTTPS, good. Google Authenticator, okay, some of you use that. SSL, passwords, only four people listed passwords as uppercase passwords. I guess there's two more down at the bottom. So I guess maybe six people with passwords, which is interesting, because I know all of you use passwords.
But are they real passwords?
They may just be passwords.
Okay, they might just be password. That's true. uBlock origin. Okay, that's a good. We will talk about that. SSH. Okay, I guess maybe I should have done the firewall. Can I firewall period again? Cryptography. Cryptography is kind of broad. It has two-factor authentication. Wireshark. Use regularly Wireshark? Really? That's kind of impressive. For those of you who don't know what Wireshark is, it's a network analysis tool. So basically lets you look at network capture.
I've got a question for you.
Yeah?
Would pen testing be actually use a qualified defense instead of, even though it's technically an offensive tool, you're actually being able to use defense?
That's a topic for this class. That's an ongoing discussion. I don't think I can answer that in 2 minutes. Virtual machines, interesting, considered as a security tool, which it definitely can be. Valve anti-cheat, traceroute, okay, seeing where things go. OpenVPN, again a VPN, netstat, okay, so no connection, netcat. I'm kind of interested, some of you use netcat, you know. Malwarebytes, file vault, you know, antivirus gets on there, a couple of forms. So just... not too different from what I'd expect. A few of them seem a little more tools. I was like, really? You use those regularly? But that's kind of what the point of the exercise was, really, to get to all this. Yeah. Thinking about what the tools are. And what I'm hoping... Come on. Go up. There we go. There, projector off. Are you serious? Okay, the one piece of chalk. Oh no! Here's the chalk on the floor. Okay. I have two pieces of chalk on the floor that are white, not just green.
That was the other thing. Well, if you want to look at the page, I don't want to go through here. But if you look at the wiki page, now actually has stuff on it. Not huge amounts, but some stuff. The big thing I came up with was my schedule. Okay, fine. So the big thing to know is that you should look through it on your own and kind of let me know if there's any major problems. The big things to note is I put the midterm after the break. So right now it's sitting at February 28th. So that's the Wednesday, February 26th, I put down as a review. And then the assignments, I put the first one due at the end of the month, January 31st, and the second one due February 14th. So just the class before the break. The idea is in that class, we'll talk about solutions for the second assignment in class. Then you'll have your break. And if you want to catch up on things, you'll be able to review things there. And then so the assignments, and then we'll have the midterm. And then assignment 3 is March 19th. Assignment 4 is April 4th. So that's not the last day of classes is April 9th for this class. Because April 11th is technically the last day of classes, but that's a Friday schedule. So we don't get that day. So last day is the 9th. I'll have the last assignment due on the 4th, so we can kind of have a class wrap-up session on the 9th. And then, of course, there'll be a final exam sometime during the final exam period. Who knows? It's always fun with that. I really think they could skip. Couldn't they compute that before the semester starts? Because they know final exams are either 2 or 3 hours. I guess they don't technically know all the classes that have final exams.
Well, but they just do it reverse than other schools where you are responsible for not booking conflicts. Except then what they do is they schedule everything and then try to schedule so there are no conflicts.
Oh, right. Yeah, the trouble is, yeah, so who's taking which classes?
Yeah.
That's the part they don't know. Okay. Anyway. So the structure, as I said, that your grade is assignments and experiences. So the idea with the experiences the assignments are kind of this well-defined, I'm going to give you some questions, give me answers, and that will get graded. The experiences are much more free-form, what I'm going to be doing is this first where I told you, here is the experience, instead of give me these list of tools. From here on out, I'm going to give you a menu. I'm going to give you a list of things for you to try. And the idea is that I want you to turn in at least 8 experiences over the course of the semester. Other than, of course, this first one. This first one was just a test one. So for each of these 8 ones, I want you to do something. We're going to come up with these, and they'll come up in class in the course of me talking about materials, like, oh, I want to do this. I am also open for you all to propose your own experiences that you want to have. And when you want to propose one, I'll actually add it. I'm going to have a wiki page of possible experiences for you to do. And maybe even have a little bit of how you get started with that. Because that's the idea of a lot of the experiences I'm going to say in class, and I'm going to get you started with it. And then from there, you can kind of go, okay, where do I go with this? So starting on Wednesday, I'll start being kind of a little more hands-on. I'll have my laptop here, and we'll start kind of like seeing some tools for at least half the class. So that's for the basis. Because the things are like, oh, you want to play with this new tool and do something. And the idea is not just, ideally, it depends on how complex the tool. Some tools are so complicated just to get them started is really hard. Other tools, other tools, it's like, okay, you should actually do something with it. Like, for example, if you're going to do something with SSH, I will point demos going through SSH in class. I don't want you just to show that you can do a public key authentication with SSH. For a class like this, I mean, I should have that as an exercise in my operating system class, but here I'd want something a bit more sophisticated. With doing it, because it turns out SSH has crazy number of things it can do, and that'll be part of what we'll be exploring, like doing with the configuration and with the use of the command line. So before I do all that, I want to spend the next, I'll start getting more hands-on next time, but the thing I want to get you all thinking about is context and how all this fits together. And the best way I can think of doing it is doing things from a historical perspective. Because I think you can only understand our current security landscape if you understand where it came from. And if you understand the past, then you'll understand things going forward. For at least the next couple of lectures, I am going to record the audio. I started doing that here. We'll see how it comes out. I'm not going to do that consistently through the class, but since I'm really going to be trying to be a bit, here's what happened, I'll at least record these. But hopefully the notes will be good. So who's taking notes for today? Oh, by the way, for those of you who have not taken notes up to this point, I now have a wiki page for you to add notes to. So now I will be doing things. It's probably, you sent me an email to create things, just message me on Slack. It'll probably be
faster response time there. So all of you have accounts on Slack now. If you have not created an account on Slack, you should. The reason why you should get an account on Slack is because you got added to CUlearn and you should have gotten messages from CUlearn. If you didn't get an announcement message from CUlearn, your configuration on CUlearn is messed up. And you need to make sure you get those. Because while I will be trying to do things through Slack, major announcements I will also post to CUlearn. Like, okay, and also you'll have to be submitting all your assignments through CUlearn. So, let's go back. What were the first computers developed for? Computing came out of?
Cracking codes.
World War II. Yes, there's the analytical engine and Babbage and Ada Lovelace and stuff, but that didn't really lead to anything. The stuff that led to stuff, like other things, was the work with, you know, over in the UK and, you know, with cryptography. The Colossus, and they were, you know, Alan Turing, while working on code breaking, was coming up with things, and he was surrounded by a lot of other people who were the first programmers. I mean, that's where it started. Bletchley Park is, you kind of say, is, I'd say, the origin place of modern computation and people working with them. So, from the perspective of systems security here, computer systems, if they are building computers, how are those systems secured?
Physical security.
Physical security. You know, who was allowed onto the facility? Who was allowed into the room? Was allowed to touch the things? That was all pure physical security. These were systems that were not fully, you know, full computational devices. Similarly, the first computers, things like ENIAC and stuff, what was security for them? Who could physically access the machine? And if you could get into that room, you could do anything to that box. Right? There were bunches of vacuum tubes and everything. So, if we're thinking about computer security from at all a modern perspective, where do those concerns start? With what sort of environment? It wasn't the earliest systems, but it was something a bit later. You know what I'm talking about?
Time sharing
systems. So first, there were the mainframes. So when we say a mainframe, we're talking about a big, expensive computer. More, you know, resource-wise, more than any one person should be able to monopolize. You know, organizations might have one of these things, and then only really rich ones. And so you have these mainframes. Now, before we have mainframes, time sharing actually came a bit later. Anyone know what was before time sharing? Batch processing. Before time sharing, there was batch processing, which means that if you were a programmer for one of these systems, you never actually touched the computer. I particularly know it's because my mom used to hold over me while I was learning computer, saying, "I did computer programming before you were born," you know, and because she had been, you know, trained and, you know, and did that. And of course, she only did it for a few years and then stopped, but she learned Fortran and stuff, but the way she programmed was, she would make up a bunch of punch cards, give it to someone, and then, you know, the next day she'd get a big printout. And that big printout, she'd look, okay, did my job run correctly, or did I have a bunch of errors? And then she'd have to create a new one, then submit it, and then we'd get a results back. So the programmers couldn't actually interact with the computer directly. They got the results back. The people, you had operators of the computer who actually entered in things and got the results out. And so again, that was real, you know, more physical security in a sense, or people. It's like, okay, yes, different people are sharing this computer, but humans are in the loop in deciding who gets access to the resource. The computer itself just does what it's told. Time sharing was a later development. The idea there is we want to use it interactively. We want to type in something, see a result. First was line printers. You know, so you would type something in a teletype, and then it would, you know, come out. And then you got screens where you'd enter text, and then it would come back. Now you have one thing. You want to have an interactive computer, and you want it to be, so we'll say interactive, and shared. Multiple people want to interact with the computer, potentially interact with it at the same time. Multiple terminals hooked up to the same computer. This is the start of computer system security. Because here, you know, it's just like with a crime, you have motive and you have opportunity. What's the motive?
Accessing anything on that remote.
Well, it's on the computer.
Oh,
it's... Yeah, so yes, there's issues of data confidentiality and things, but you know, mostly these folks are kind of authorized and stuff. That's not quite what I'm talking about here. I think the first motive...
They want more time.
They want more time. They want more resources. This computer is this, you know, limited resource, and they want their jobs to run faster. They want to be able to put more jobs on them. They want faster response time. Yeah. They want to use it for games, and they're not authorized to use it for games. So if you look back at the history of these early systems, early time-sharing systems, you see that there are people putting forth policies about how these computers are supposed to be used. And then there's the people actually using the systems who go, I don't think so, and try to violate that policies. So this is the start of the technical mechanisms for, so this gets to a big word in computer security, which is policy. When we talk about policy, what we're talking about is the rules. What are the rules for the system to obey? Now, policy is not the same as mechanism, because this starts from an organizational standpoint. This is like human resources policy. It's like anti-harassment policy. It's the organization saying, this is what you shall use a computer for, and this is what you shall not use the computer for, and this is how you shall use it. And then the people using the computer said, oh, you know, maybe we should actually make the computer enforce the policy ourselves, because we don't want to watch people as they use computers all the time. Programmers are lazy. So they think of programs to enforce policies and other programs. And, you know, programs to enforce policies on users. So notice the key difference here from the past is now the computer has been given the power to say no. I will not do this. But the motivation for not doing it is this notion of policy. And you know, are you supposed to? It's not really about, you know, data confidentiality. That's not what FIRST was. FIRST was just about, you know, you're getting billed per minute of using the system. And people go, well, you know, if I could just shut off the billing system, I could have my game run all night and I wouldn't get charged, and that'd be great. So they want to avoid policy because people like to break rules. And why shouldn't they want to break rules when you use a computer, just like breaking rules doing anything else? So you go from that. So you could say, we'll say, you know, we'll call this the first year. Now, notice time-sharing systems, you know, the difference between, you know, well, you know, local versus remote with time-sharing systems is a little bit of a funny thing, because really all you have is terminals. And the terminals could be connected by a direct hard line that would say in the facility, or it could be via a modem. And so then you're using the telephone network basically to extend your wire, and then you're accessing it. But still, you're having to go through the same sort of authentication piece. Although you might want to restrict with, you know, the phone numbers that should be accessible. Anyone remember War Games? You know, the movie? Classic hacking movie, kind of one of the early ones.
Oh, the only winning move is not to play.
Yes, the only winning move is not to play. Well, so the story in this movie is that there is this mainframe, this Whopper computer, that sits there and simulates global thermonuclear war in various ways, and some kid breaks into it, activates an AI that was, you know, not running before, and the AI starts simulating global thermonuclear war and then actually wants to play it for real because it thinks it's all a game and it wants to win. So there's a comment in the movie where they say, how could a kid dial in to our ultra-secure mainframe? The phone company messed up. There wasn't supposed to be the ability to dial into this computer. It was an ultra-high security thing. You shouldn't have been able to use kit at home, shouldn't be able to use their modem. It was supposed to be restricted. They were probably supposed to have leased lines, dedicated phone lines, so you could only from certain locations access it. But now some kid who was trying to find a game company to hack in so he could get the latest game before they were released, instead ends up talking to a computer that controls nuclear weapons. Oops. But notice there, that means that the frontline security of that system, I mean, in some sense, the first line of defense in the time-sharing era was obscurity. They aren't really hardened systems, because the number of people who could access these systems was always relatively few. They wouldn't know about them. They wouldn't know how to operate them. I'm not saying people couldn't break in, but anyone who had a clue about these systems could circumvent the security. They were much more constrained by organizational policy than they were by technical mechanisms. The technical mechanisms were there more to keep people honest. So if you research those systems, they were Swiss cheese. And everyone who knew anything about how they operated knew it. So that's time sharing. Now, when we talk about eras, it's always kind of, you can't really do time that much. But I'll put some kind of a separate thing, and then we'll kind of talk about how to get a kind of. I call the second era personal computers. So what I mean by personal computers is things, well, you know, before you had mainframes, and yes, there's minis and other things, but minis are really operational here. Even like mainframes, they operate like personal computers. The key difference here is with mainframes, you have interactive time-sharing systems. With personal computers, it's a computer for a person. It's your computer. And the interesting thing about personal computers is they're kind of like the older, you know, systems, in the sense of what controlled the security of the device was fundamentally physical security. If you get on the computer, you could access anything. But there was a security concern with these personal computers. And it comes from kind of a funny source. What's the real driver? There's two drivers of security in the personal computer era. Well, I guess it's really one.
Hiding personal information, I'm guessing?
Hiding personal information?
Yeah.
Not at all. Because remember, this is before interconnection. This is single computers. We'll talk about when we start interconnecting computers later.
Is it about identification of whose computer it's making?
Nope. Not identification.
Protecting the computer from the user?
No, the computer will let you do whatever you want.
personal computer era, it was all about copy protection and software piracy. Because you have all these computers out there, and what do computer users always want to do? Play games. Or they might want to run business software too. That was also there. But let's face it, the big copy protection stuff was around the games. And so you have these games that people want to make money on by selling them, and then you had other people who would copy them and give them to their friends and share them all over the place. And that's so this, notice the fundamentally different threat model when you get into this. I mean, in the mainframe model, you have multiple users on a single computer and they're trying to share, and really, you mostly assume people are basically trustworthy because access to these systems are limited, but you're putting in place rules to enforce policy. And it's really about saying, oh, you've done something that violated policy. Yes, you could technically get around it if you knew really what you were doing, but otherwise we'll enforce this on you. With personal computers, this is about, I'm a vendor. I have made software, and I'm going to distribute it to people. And I want them just to use the copy I gave them. I don't want them to copy that disk, but you've given them a copy. You just don't want them to make another copy. That's a little funny, because what are computers really good at? Copying information. It's kind of their thing. And you're telling them not to do kind of their prime directive. That's copy protection. And you know, this is certainly my first exposure to computer security because, you know, my friend would buy a game and I want the game. And so it was also kind of a fun challenge, like, can we copy the game? And so there'd be all these programs for copying programs, these copy programs, and generally the copies would be pirated too, of those. And you sit there and try to use it and see, can I get a good copy? Okay, it's working. And then try running it, like, no, it didn't run. And if you really, you know, go down that path, it all goes into all the stuff we talk about, reverse engineering and other things, but trying to figure out how to break these systems to prevent them from being copied. I mean, they would do things like use custom operating systems, custom disk formats, because all this stuff was under software control on most of these systems. Or they deliberately introduce errors, sometimes use a laser to punch little holes that would generate errors, and of course, how do you reproduce an error produced by a hole in a floppy disk? You're gonna punch a tiny little hole in the floppy disk in the precisely the right location? Well, you know, if you scramble the bits just right, it kind of looks like a hole. It's like read write. I mean, or you can just patch the program so it doesn't actually do that check anymore. But this had a rather odd outcome. Something else came out of this. So you have bunches of people sharing information on disks without necessarily checking where that disk came from. What's this a medium for?
Viruses.
This led because all you'd have to do with these kind of systems, like, well, everyone's sharing these floppies back and forth. Well, what if you just make it so when you have the program, you know, one floppy in, it just leaves a little bit of stuff in memory. So when you restart the computer, it doesn't quite restart, it doesn't erase everything, and then that gets fed another computer. Or what if the program that's copying the disk actually is infected and kind of adds a little something to the floppy disk? I mean, there's all kinds of techniques for how you do this. But the fact is you're sharing information between computers. Even though they're not networked, you still are propagating information. In addition to the information you want to propagate, information that you don't want to propagate also comes along. So why am I differentiating these? Because if you look at the problems of the modern day,
they're really about a mix between these two things. When you introduce networking, what you get is unauthorized access to information. People wanting to violate various kinds of policy. Maybe people inside the organization, maybe people outside. But they're really kind of, you know, someone has some, you know, maybe some valuable information, valuable resources that they don't want to be shared, and others want to get at it. Or they have a computer that someone wants to be able to get at. Or you're dealing with malicious software. And there isn't a clear line between these two, of course. Oftentimes, to do one, you use other. Malicious software is used to accomplish these goals, these, you know, once you can violate policy, you can then use that to install malicious software. It's not a clear division, but it's interesting. It's useful, I think, to think about these things as different origins and different, in a sense, cultures that have kind of come together and mixed once time sharing and personal computers kind of all got connected together on what we know as the internet.
What would be the point of computer viruses if there's no network? Like, if you just create a virus, you send it to someone else, and then it gets spread, how would you know what happens to it?
Okay, well, that's a good question.
Pranks, I mean, just wanting to break things.
So pranks, partially. Also, people started, some of that stuff was malicious. Remember, in this era, it wasn't just copying things. Once you start getting hard drives, so when your computers just had a floppy drive, so all the state was there, that would be one thing. But people kept doing this sort of stuff when they got hard drives. So now, you have the equivalent of many floppy drives connected to the system. That virus now could erase everything. Or could, in principle, even do ransomware. Like, you have to call up a phone number. And you have to...
Most of the viruses I got when I was a kid was like the equivalent of spray painting your name on the underpass.
Yeah. Yeah.
That purple monkey.
Yeah. It was mostly, you know, look what I can do. Because why not? But some of them were malicious. Some of them would erase computers, erase the information of it. And some of them had, like, some of them were quiet. They would propagate, and then on a certain time of day, you know, a certain day of the year, they would then do this. So I'd say, like, you know, the early PCs, you know, the 8-bit computers, the viruses weren't that, I mean, there were viruses, but that interesting. I mean, they're kind of interesting from a technical point of view, but not necessarily from a, you know, they've done that much damage, but as got the more of the PC era, you know, I mean, PC compatibles and, you know, hard drives and stuff, then it got much more serious. Because then also those hard drives might actually have business information. But again, it wasn't necessarily easy to extract information from it, so it's more like you destroy things, malicious. But, you know, then I'd say, once you really start networking computers together, all the problems of both of these worlds come together and feed off each other and amplify each other. And then, you know, initially when originally when networks were smaller, you'd start seeing propagating malware inside organizations. You'd see people trying to break into servers, trying to get access to things they wouldn't want to do. You'd see, you know, insider trading, trying to steal secrets from a company. You'd see someone trying to do embezzlement or other kinds of white-collar crime. They would try and use computers and stuff inside an organization. But then once you have the internet now, everyone's connected, so the attacks are all connected. So what mechanisms that we develop along the way in these different eras? So what's the legacy of the mainframes? What security mechanisms did we get from them?
Access control.
So the big one for that era is access control. You gotta have users, groups,
you know, all the classics, you know, you got permissions, and you got an access control list. This is all really, you know, who's allowed, you know, what's an access control? What's access control? You say, who are you? What's your privileges? What are you allowed to do? What resources do you have access to? You have entities, you have labels. We'll talk about the theory of access control and stuff, but that's, it's just formalizing something that should be very simple. It's like, who are you? What are you allowed to do? You're in HR? Okay, you're allowed to access the HR records. You're in shipping? You're allowed to access the shipping system. Yep. Who you are, what's your role in the organization, that's what you have access to. And along with this, we'll have passwords. Now remember, again, passwords fit into a world where it's not that the technical mechanisms are not circumventable. It's about the mechanisms trying to enforce policy. And the organization saying, these are the rules, and so it's obvious that if you want to break the rules, you're gonna have to go around it, you know it, and then you just have to kind of watch out for people trying to break the rules. What we get from the personal computer era? What's the big technology that came out of there? Oh, come on.
Antivirus?
Antivirus. So this one. Let's check if I stick in that floppy disk. Let me make sure, is it infected with anything? You better scan it. See if there's something really dangerous on it before we access it, because otherwise it keeps out of trouble. So when you get into the modern era between, you know, when you start with the internet, you get these things that kind of come, this access control stuff, and then you get this anti-malware stuff, and then the stuff, and really when you look at, you know, and it's certainly not all security mechanisms, but a lot of the mechanisms that we have today seem more like, okay, they're trying to enforce a policy, or they're trying to find bad things, bad software. So why were the two worlds, kind of, in a sense, we get the worst of both worlds when we see these two combined. So the nastiness of the combination is when you had time-sharing systems, it's not to say you couldn't write malicious software on them. It's just that the software was confined to the organization. So if you wrote malicious software and you kind of messed things up, you potentially had someone else in the organization smack you down. So what was the motive for doing it? Basically, it would be sabotaging the organization. And most of the time, you wouldn't really need to make very sophisticated software. You just need to kind of bypass the controls that, you know, people in the know already knew how to do. With personal computers, though, you had a genuine arms race. Copy protection, you had ever more elaborate forms of copy protection. It led to ever more sophisticated folks being able to reverse engineer things. Those skills, I would argue, that were fostered in this battle is exactly what provided the foundation for making malicious software. Because what are the skills you need for developing malicious software? You need to be able to understand how the system works and be able to manipulate it. That's what it is when you're, you know, playing this game. Those same skills are very portable to just making code that replicates itself. It's having to do all the same kind of tricks. So you put those folks who have these skills and have access to other systems that have only been protected by policy before and by general convention, and you go, you know, what do they look at those systems? They go,
this looks fun. So when you hear about folk, all the early work, all this early security work on the internet, and all the things in the 90s and stuff when the web was really, so the internet goes back to the 70s. The web goes back to the early 90s. There was lots of networking, the internet was definitely before that, but before the web, the internet was the province of a relatively small elite, because people sent email and exchanged files, maybe remote logged in. That's what the internet was used for. The whole notion of it being a general information resource was something that came along with the web. But that was the killer app for the internet that made everyone want to use it. The technology had been developed decades before. But what was, anyone know what the first real major piece of malware was on the internet? We'll talk about it in more detail later, but something known as the Morris worm. Now the Morris worm is kind of an exact example of what I'm talking about here, the combination of skills. Because here it was something that used various software bugs in order to be able to circumvent access controls. In order to be able to make software that would break into a computer system. And the original design of the Morris worm was not malicious. All Robert Morris wanted to do, I think it was Robert Morris. There's like two major Morrises in computer science, so that's why I was, what's a father-son pair. So it's the son who did it. Of course, now he's quite senior and actually very well respected. But what he was trying to do was just send out a program that would replicate throughout the internet and just kind of do a survey. He just wanted to make a program that would just kind of go to every computer and just see how many computers could it get to. He didn't want people to catch him. He wanted it to be quiet. But the idea is it was supposed to be stealthy. But his code was buggy. It kept infecting the same systems over and over again. As a result, it caused those systems to crash. And that's why everyone kind of went like, oh my God. So actually, there might have been other malware on the internet that was roaming around that no one knows about because they actually did it competently. The Morris worm was buggy. But of course, actually, most software is buggy. So the notion that you release something and it'll be bug-free seems kind of silly. So I don't necessarily think there was probably anything before that. But the Morris worm was released, it went around these systems, and within the matter of hours, it caused thousands of computers to crash. Basically, you could probably at least a third of the internet at that time just go down. This was like 89. So this is before the web. Again, all these systems I was connecting to were like VAX, DNS systems. They had policies for restricting who should be able to access these things. But by using software flaws, they are able to circumvent the access controls and use the computer for their own ends. So that's the frame. That's how things have kind of developed. Good. It's really annoying. I can't see the time. Okay, I've got you. Let's go a little more in depth about what mechanisms do we have today and try to be very specific. And the first one I want to talk about in a little bit of depth is the Unix security model. I think a lot of you are pretty familiar with it, but still worth reviewing. So what is the Unix security model? You have users. You have groups. What is a user and what is a group? Well, we'll always say this is actually a user space component. Really, it's a UID and a GID. In user space, we map those UIDs and GIDs, the numbers, to specific users and groups. That's what the etc password and the etc group files do. But what is these numbers? It's just labels. That's all they are. They're just labels. The labels applied to what? They're applied to only two things.
Process. Process.
Yeah, they're applied to. Yeah, so these are labels. They're labels for files and directories, so labels in the file system, and they're labels for processes. That's it. The whole notion of the Unix security model is saying, okay, every process has a label of a user, has a label of a group. Every file and directory has labels for users and groups. And then we have rules, the Unix permission bits, which basically says, okay, I have a process with certain labels. Is it allowed to manipulate this file or directory? Now you have the user, group, and other permissions with, with read, write, execute. And there's also things like the sticky bit. I mean, there's a couple of little things like sticky bits and set UID bits and other things, but the basic outline of it is processes have labels and files have labels. And who's that allowed to access which? This whole notion, as it should seem clear, when you talk about users and groups, this is an organizational concept. This is something straight from the mainframe time-sharing era. Say, what are the humans who should use this computer? What group are they part of? And like, what organizational group? And this part of the organization has access to certain resources, and these individuals have access to certain resources, and let's allocate this way. Now, Unix permissions are far from the only way this is done. There's actually, Windows has its own way of doing this, and in the past, there were many other ways of mapping this. And if you go to enterprises, there's many other ways, very elaborate ways of mapping labels to computational resources and, files and directories, or you talk about database tables or database rows or stuff like that, but it's the same basic idea as the question of being more or less elaborate. My question for you is this: why are these on your phone or on your laptop? I mean, to a first blush, it seemed like, this is stupid. My phone is not a multi-user system. My laptop is, it's my laptop. I'm the one who uses it. But you go underneath every system that we run today that runs a modern operating system. So when I say runs a modern operating system, it has some sort of modern kernel. So it has, user space and, supervisor mode, user mode. Which is nowadays most computation systems, unless you're talking about really embedded systems. And the reason why you do this is because you have this sort of model when you want to run lots of processes and you want them to interact with the network. Because you want high concurrency, you need lots of concurrency in order to be able to handle networking. Everything's networked, so everything's got this architecture. But why stick this in here? seems like a dumb model to associate with operating systems that run on everything, even like your watch. So why? Why is this still around? Is it just an archaic thing that we just sort of bypass? Or does it have real utility in the modern era? What's this for? Yeah, no, there's processes, there's UIDs. I'm saying this is a core part of modern system security. I'm saying the concepts, however, come from an era decades ago whose requirements are vastly different than what we have today. The mechanisms persist, and I will tell you, have utility. I'm asking, why do they have utility? What is that utility?
Apply policies.
Yep, it is applying policies, that's it. But what sort of policies? That's true. We still have policies we want to apply. And that's part of why this sticks around. And in some sense, you could say this is just sort of a general labeling thing, but.
But if you have to, it may make you aware if you're doing something that modifies something that with a higher level of permission. Like if you're not an administrator and then ask for an admin password in a situation where it shouldn't, then you might know that you have something that's doing something weird.
Okay. There might be something like, okay, so you're saying there's some sort of innate notion of protection, but this is a lot more complicated than you need for just something like that.
Isn't it because certain processes shouldn't have access to the whole computer?
Certain processes should, okay, so that's part of the policy, mm-hmm. and the shouldn't.
Like shouldn't try to
But let's go a little further with that.
It protects like the core system, so like you can't just go into the system files and modify it if there's a random program running.
So it restricts the access of certain programs. Yeah, that's a key part of it.
It protects them from like each other, the program from each other. Like if I write errant code that runs off and ruins a bunch of memory, if we both have access to the same.
We've identified with a mechanism that keeps programs from messing with each other. Right? This is a way to keep programs from messing with each other, if we're messing with different files. But that's not the problem that's being solved. I'm saying the problem that was solved before was this issue of organizations and knowing how to have kind of policy for them. What's the problem that we're solving?
If a user has malicious code, it can't spread.
Okay. Now notice, so prevent the spread of malicious software. Maybe. But if we take this whole notion, remember the whole copy protection, it's like if they found a flaw in the security system, they're going to still have a flaw in the security system, they'll be able to bypass everything. This is in a sense, this works to the degree which everyone can be kept to follow the rules. I'm not saying that, you know, maybe you have different mechanisms to make sure the rules can't be broken. But why do I need to make sure I can enforce the rules? Malware, maybe. But I'm saying if it's real malware, I might be able to break all the stuff.
Prevent you from executing code you're not supposed to execute.
Here's my hint. When you say you, who is you?
I guess other people remotely connecting to your stuff and running code that might not be attached, so they might have a different UID, which when they write the code would, I guess, check if they were able to do it then, because they're remotely connected to a device that's only works.
Okay, so remote access to a system, but then the use case really becomes something like the old era of things. So, and remote access, I mean, yes, you can log into many systems, but that's not really the use case.
Prevent user error.
Okay, so you could say, well, it's just useful to kind of maybe separate out things so that one user can't actually damage the whole system. Okay, but again, you got much simpler mechanisms.
Protect one user from another user on the same computer.
Right, but most of these systems we're talking about are not multi-user. So it couldn't be simplified. If you look in a modern Linux system, it has a lot of users. You know, a lot of accounts.
Maybe possibly the user modifying, I guess, the core kernel code enough for it to kind of cause like a break in and of itself.
Oh, okay, so maybe modern kernel code, but again, access control, I mean, that's access control mechanisms don't protect the kernel.
Right.
Except maybe to prevent you from like replacing the kernel image when you reboot. I mean, that's the extent of it. I mean, but you could do a lot of simpler things for that. So what I'm trying to get at is modern systems are in effect multi-user, but they're multi-user in a funny way. It's not that there's multiple people using the device, it's that many different developers have created software to run on the same device. The platform is shared, but it's shared between applications running on behalf of often the same individual. But because they're coming from different sources, they may have different agendas, different goals. They may even be in direct conflict. Some of them may in fact be malware. But even if they're not malware, they just potentially shouldn't be allowed to see all the stuff. So one of the big uses for this sort of labeling is just saying, who gets what? Who are you? Now, you might say, well, that doesn't map precisely onto things. And you're right, it doesn't. And so if you look at modern, if you look at desktop operating systems, the users are used to separate background applications. So like different, like maybe, you know, you have your print server or your web server starting to run with different users versus your main stuff. The accounts aren't used that much. They don't really bother you much. But they're there and they at least, it's kind of like, okay, well, let's prevent the user from doing stupid things. We already have this mechanism, so we'll just use it. But they've gotten really a lot more traction now in the space of mobile operating systems, particularly things like Android. Users are associated with different applications. And they all get their own permissions. The idea is there, okay, now we've isolated you using this mechanism, which was designed for preventing, you know, individuals from, you know, messing with each other on a computer. Now we're preventing applications from messing with each other on a computer. Is it the best fit? It works to some degree, and then it gets supplemented by other things, but that's, you could say, well, why don't we just create the right mechanism? Why don't we throw all that stuff out and do it correctly? And the answer, why not, is very simple. It's called legacy software. And when we say legacy software, I'm saying legacy software in the broadest sense. It's not just, okay, here's an application that someone developed, you know, 10 years ago and no one understands it, and so now we have to use it. I'm talking about the core software foundation on which all of our tools operate. Expect a system that works this way. So if you were to throw this out, you kind of, those programs might kind of go like, whoa, what do I do? You'd have to rewrite them. So we use all that foundation. And we kind of use these concepts and we turn them around for our own purposes. That doesn't mean they're a good fit. That doesn't mean necessarily they're a bad fit. But to understand why they work the way they do, it's important to understand where they came from. And then you go, okay, well, does it work in this situation? Kind of. And what we generally do is, okay, it covers this much of the problem, then I'll add in a hack for the rest. I'm sorry if this insults you. I'm sorry if this bothers you. That's the world. And that's the world because no one wants to pay anyone to develop everything from scratch. And even if they did, they'd do it badly.
Yeah, it might not even be better, right?
It wouldn't necessarily be better. And especially when you talk about security mechanisms. Because the thing to understand about the way things work on modern boxes, particularly Unix boxes, is that they co-evolved with the rise of the internet.
which means that all these problems that, you know, the security problems of the internet have been getting worse and worse and worse. And our systems have been getting better and better and better at dealing with them. If you create a new system, you have to deal with the fact that you've got to have to deal with all that. I mean, if you get any sort of level of popularity, you have to deal with all the hardening, all the lessons learned on how to use these mechanisms. And that's a big cliff to climb. Third question?
Yeah, could you give me an example of a piece of software that would be considered a big group?
So, if you look at group, so one common thing used for groups is that on a Ubuntu system, there's a decision of, is this a regular user or is this an administrative user? And the difference is the regular users do not have sudo access, and administrative users do. That's denoted by what group they're in. If you're a part of the right group, I forget which group it is, the admin group or something.
Wheel.
Hmm? Is it Wheel on Ubuntu? I don't think it's Wheel on Ubuntu. That's a classic name for it.
It's like Red Hat.
Yeah, Red Hat may use a Wheel. That's the old-fashioned name for the vote those who have.
Just admin.
It might be admin.
Or just sudo.
It might be sudo, yeah. But that is denoted with a group. And if you add a user to the right group, they now, if they hit sudo, type sudo, in effect what there's a policy. The sudo binary is set UID root, which means when the sudo binary is invoked, that process runs with root privileges, the effective user ID of root. That binary has a policy file which decides what it allows to run as root. And in doing so, it looks at the standard policy file on like Mac systems or other ones. Well, what group is the user in? If they're part of the right group, allow them to do the access if they type in the right password. That's how those mechanisms are deployed. There is a side group here that I did not talk about, which actually I should mention in terms of computer security, although I think they've had, in effect, much less influence than they like to say. I mean, this group often likes to say, oh yeah, we figured it all out and we've done it all, and you go like, no, you haven't. That group is the military. The military, of course, they cared about security from the beginning because that's what they do. They care about security. And so when they started bringing computers into their systems, they wanted to enforce security policies. And then they had security policies that they actually assumed that some people in the organization would want to circumvent. They didn't have this notion that, okay, yeah, the permissions are basically trustworthy, but we'll deal with it with, you know, organizational things and have trustworthy people. They actually had systems where they wanted to keep information secret. In particular, they wanted to do things like enforce classification levels. Now, the notion of some information having a classification level doesn't seem that different from labels of any other kind. Okay, you just label it saying, oh, this is secret, this is top secret, this is compartmentalized, you know, or something. You just have all these, oh, this is unclassified, this is sensitive. I mean, these are just labels to a computer, what's the big deal? But the military were the first ones to say, oh, computers having those labels, they actually need to enforce them. They need to make sure they actually work. So if you look at the history of computer security, the military and intelligence organizations, which I really think is part of the military, warfare by other means, you know, they were the ones who said, we need to come up with standards for how to build computer systems. There are things known as the Orange Book, and there's common criteria, and there's other various standards for how you're supposed to build computers with military-type security. Mostly that stuff is irrelevant today. And that stuff is irrelevant for a very simple reason. All those organizations first of all, they tried paying for them, and they hated the systems that were produced. No one liked to use them. They were ultra-secure systems that no one could get any work done on. And those systems
Then the internet came along, and then all the generals and everyone else wanted to be able to use this internet thing. And so they wanted to be able to use all the cool office software that everyone else was using. So commercial off-the-shelf software took over all those organizations. And if you're curious, why do we hear about things like Edward Snowden and folks leaking all these information, these ultra-classified networks, and shouldn't they be able to keep secrets? They're running the same crap everyone else is. Why should they be able to secure it any better than anyone else? And they can't. I'm not saying they don't have offensive capabilities that are quite remarkable. They do, but that's a specialized set of tools. You just give some smart folks the time and resources to develop them. They can develop software to break into other systems. That's no big deal. But defending an entire organization? That's a very different problem. And there's no evidence that government organizations at any level are any better at it than the private sector, and arguably, I would say the private sector is better at it. Because most of the organizations that really want to protect themselves develop their own tech. See, which do I think is harder to break into? Given governmental facility or Google or Facebook systems? Google or Facebook. Now, not to say that the military can't do certain mechanisms to make it kind of hard, like they do things like air gap systems and say, okay, this is cut off from the world, and so it can't actually talk to the open internet. But remember, we had computer viruses and stuff before networking. And the same, as long as information flows from systems back and forth, there's a way of getting malicious stuff onto it. In the old days, it was floppy drives. Today, it's USB sticks. Information has to come in and out. And that can carry malicious payloads. I mean, if you look at some of the really sophisticated, you all have heard of Stuxnet, right? Stuxnet was spread by the equivalent of floppy disks, i.e. USB sticks. What's a great test of for any, if you have a, if a red team comes to your organization, one way they love breaking into systems, well, it's an old trick. I don't think they generally have to do that, but drop a bunch of USB sticks in a parking lot with malware. And wait for someone to take it and plug it into a sensitive computer. Because people are curious. And you know what organizations do to try to prevent this? The epoxy USB stick, USB ports. They literally glue them shut. So you can't stick a USB stick into it. But even then, that's not enough, because there always has to be some way to get information on those systems. So otherwise, the people actually trying to do the work go like, how do I get information onto my system? And if you actively prevent them from doing it, they find a way to get around it. Because we live in a connected world, whether we like it or not. So we have another 5-10 minutes. So one of the lessons for today, you can understand any mechanism by looking at where it came from. Under what circumstances was it developed? What problem was it designed to solve? While you can use that mechanism for other purposes, it will tend to be limited in those other circumstances. And looking back, we see that we're in a world today that is not like the eras in which the virtual versions of our tools was developed. It's a new thing because it combines elements of these different, of these different problem domains. The folks trying to break copy protection and folks trying to just get around and deal with access control systems. And that's why we have and that's part of why we have such bad security. It's nothing that our systems were not developed for the problems that we face, and that's everything about them, including the security systems. The modern internet is the result of evolution. It's technical evolution. It started with one thing and it became something else. And the best example I can think about that is the problem of mobile code.
sometime just for grins, look up the literature on mobile code. Try looking at the literature on secure mobile code. And see, like, people thought about mobile code and thought about how to make it secure. They thought about ways to do it. And that stuff went nowhere. Yet somehow, we live in a world which is full of mobile code. You know what we call that mobile code? JavaScript. What is JavaScript except mobile code? And you might say, what do you mean? I just get it from one site. No, you don't. You load a web page which contains JavaScript from maybe 20 different organizations or more, all running within the same sandbox. It's fully mobile code, and that stuff talks to remote servers. They communicate, they coordinate across the entire internet to do various tasks like track what you've been looking at. No one designed the system. No one intended it for to be built this way. Yet, it exists because of lots of little decisions all along the way. And that's the fundamental challenge when you're dealing with computer security. Is you can't think of it as, I'm going to solve this problem today. If you think you're going to solve this problem today, tomorrow you're going to find that actually your solution is the problem. Your mechanisms will be used by defenders in new ways and by attackers. I want you to think, we'll talk about this next time, but what am I talking about specifically by tools? I'm going to use both the defenders and attackers. So Wednesday we'll talk about the first assignment, and we'll start talking about experiences.